Welcome to the Daily Dive Weekend Edition. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and every week I explore the top stories making waves in the news and some that are just plain interesting. I'll connect you with the journalists and the people who know the story and bring you news without the noise so you can make an informed decision. You can catch a new episode of the Daily Dive every Monday through Friday, and it's ready when you wake up. On the Weekend Edition, I'll be bringing you some of the best stories from the week. One of the ongoing top stories is how the economy is recovering. The economic recovery of the United States has been uneven as some workers and companies are showing signs of coming out just fine, and others face an uncertain path. While a lot of people were hoping for some type of V-shaped recovery where the comeback rose quickly, it actually represents more of a K-shaped recovery, with people on the upper arm recovering quickly and people on the lower arm having a much more difficult time. The pandemic has been kind to those that can work from home and the businesses that cater to them, but lower wage workers and those tied to tourism and public gatherings have suffered. The economic recovery is even disproportionate according to region. Places like Hawaii, Las Vegas, New York, and Los Angeles that are really tied to tourism are having a tough time making a comeback, and the workers there as well. So for more on this K-shaped recovery, we'll speak to Teo Francis, business reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
I mean, if you look at the overall numbers, we're clearly coming back from a deep round of economic crisis. But for some people, that recovery is almost done. You have essentially white-collar workers, people who can do their jobs from home. You have companies that either employ white-collar workers primarily or provide services that can be done at a distance. You have highly educated people. For them, this recovery is well on its way. And in fact, at some companies, really, there's been kind of a boom in demand for things like cloud services or grocery stores. There's been, you know, a rise in shopping for necessities for companies like Amazon. Things are actually better than they were. Home Depot, catering to people who are sort of adding on to their house or improving their house and yard. But the other half, or the other part of the population, is on that lower arm of the K. These are people whose jobs depend on face-to-face contact and yet don't benefit from this demand for, you know, home building supplies and that kind of thing. These are people who are, in many cases, on the lower end of the educational spectrum, people who are on the lower end of the wage spectrum, and then places that are really heavily dependent on tourism and travel, which, of course, are industries that have been really hard hit.
So let's break it down a little bit. As far as how it goes for workers, it really does seem to be that people and the industries and all that, they were able to send their employees home to work from home, really are doing the best. And then the businesses that are catering to them. So, you know, you talk about like Amazon doing really great because people are just ordering stuff from home. They're sending things there. So those industries have also been doing good. So this kind of work from home thing really seems to be a major turning point in how well people are doing.
If you think about it, the economic crisis was brought about because of the shutdowns that were done in response to a virus, right? And a virus is contagious among people when they're in relatively close proximity to each other. So the shutdowns were aimed to stop that. And so what did you do? You really sent people home. And if you could keep working, like I can keep working, I can do my job from home. A lot of white collar workers can, and they did. And their companies adapted, and that took a little effort and probably a little bit of expense, like more Zoom meetings, and maybe some people got allowances for a desk chair or something at home. And that actually prompted some spending. But a lot of people can't do that. There are some jobs that it's just very difficult to do at home. Some of those have been coming back as, you know, the auto garages have reopened and that sort of thing. Places where maybe people aren't face-to-face with their customers or one another quite so much, or you can adapt the business model to that. But there are businesses where that's not the case. Think about a movie theater. Think about live sports. Think about theaters and concert venues. I mean, these are all places where people go to be together, to see something live and in person. And that's really hard to fix in a pandemic.
And those people that work on those industries, you know, a lot of them saw furloughs for the first few months. A lot of those furloughs are becoming permanent now. You mentioned movie theaters. Regal Cinemas is closing, basically suspending all operations in the United States. Disney announced 28,000 layoffs last week. You know, these furloughs are becoming permanent, and so they're really feeling the pain of it. And that's just kind of prolonging how long their return will be.
In a real sense, what you're seeing is the cautious optimism of the first part of the pandemic really turn into pessimism for a lot of people. And one thing they ask is they ask people whether they think their layoffs are temporary or permanent. And just as the summer has worn on and now we're into fall, you really saw fewer and fewer people saying that they thought their layoffs were just going to be temporary. In other words, there's this realization that at least for certain segments of the economy and places and in the country, this is not going to be a temporary thing. This is going to drag on.
The economic return is kind of uneven all over the place. You know, I suggest everybody go and read your article because you lay it out really well. But, you know, there's the workers, there's the industries, and there's the regions also. You mentioned tourism. All these states and cities that dealt heavily with tourism, they're seeing an uneven return. Hawaii, because their travel restrictions in place, has seen a big downturn. Las Vegas the same way, Los Angeles, New York, all these big hubs where people would go all the time. You know, they're not going, or it's harder for them to return as well, and their workers as well.
You look at two places right next to each other, like Nevada and Utah. These states are literally next door to each other. Nevada has been hit very hard, and Utah is among the less hard hit states. And a big part of that is this dependence on face-to-face, in this case, tourism-related activity.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, and the recovery, as I mentioned, is just kind of uneven all over the place. But hopefully things start getting back into motion, and we can see some of these gains back in these places that really need it. Tayo Francis, business reporter at The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been hearing a lot of stories about colleges exploding with COVID-19 cases. But one college in Maine has been keeping the numbers down with mandatory mask wearing, students willing to follow the rules, and one of the nation's most rigorous testing programs. Colby College has poured about $10 million into its response plan and tests students twice a week. And for all of their efforts, they've had fewer than 12 cases since the semester began in August. And one of the other byproducts about this is how ordinary everything feels on the grounds. The result, they have a bustling campus, students are playing frisbee on lawns, working on their laptops, and going to classes. So for more on how Colby College is keeping the numbers low, we'll speak to Chris Quintana, national education reporter at USA Today.
So back in the summer, they announced this big plan, a $10 million investment, and part of it was they were going to test their students often and repeatedly. So that looks like initially three times a week, and so that, you know, that's a lot to be tested. And now it's down to two times a week, which is still a bit more than most of the American population, I imagine, is being tested. You know, another part of that is what you mentioned, that the mask mandate. Another part of it is just messaging and also emptying out the dorms a little bit and using other space available to spread students out a little bit. The college had a hotel that they were planning to open in downtown Waterville, and you know, they used that for student housing instead. So there's a lot going on here, but the thing that kind of stands out to most people is just the sheer testing. You know, they've done 41,000 tests since they've been back in class.
And that's definitely going to help catch things quickly. You know, most colleges right now, their plans, when somebody gets infected, they'll send students home, which a lot of public health experts said is probably not the best, because then you're just sending a sick person to another area. And, you know, there could be some community spread there. Other campuses, you know, lock down, they'll have students stay in student housing or something like that. What does Colby College do if somebody comes down with coronavirus?
They have quarantine and isolation housing set aside, right? So the idea being that if you have the virus or you come in close contact with someone who did have it, you can kind of stay in a separate space, still in town, still taking your classes, but you're kind of removed from the general population so as not to risk further spread. But just given kind of the way that the Colby program has gone so far, they haven't really had to use a whole lot of that yet.
They've only had fewer than 12 cases since the semester began in August. So that's great compared to some of the numbers you're hearing in other places, hundreds of students getting tested. And you know, some of these other schools have thousands and thousands, 30,000 students and all, but still fewer than 12 cases is great anywhere, really. One of the other things that they do is they require students to download an app on their phone, which helps with the contact tracing and helps deliver them the results of their test. Tell us a little bit about that.
So, you know, it's something that's installed on most students' phones, and, you know, it does deliver the test results. And what's impressive about that is, you know, you can get a test on Wednesday and get your results by Thursday, which is some of the quickest turnaround protesting that I've certainly heard of. I mean, I've been tested here in Washington, D.C. through the public program, and it took several days and, you know, was sent to me via email. So kind of having that all on hand is certainly useful. And, you know, the app also has other aspects of it. You know, when students go to campus or, you know, just going about their day, they're required to list their symptoms, you know, if they're feeling any symptoms of the virus, you know, fatigue or fever or kind of loss of taste or smell. And so in that way, the idea is that you can kind of track ahead of the virus before it shows up in the test necessarily.
Tell us a little bit more about how the testing works, because my understanding is they have a big tent, the students file in, and then they administer the test to themselves before they pass it along to be sent out to the lab.
So, you know, kind of any time during the day, you'll see students migrating towards the central tent on campus. And part of that, they check in, they get their little vial, and then they administer the test themselves. It's a nasal test, and it's not the long ones that I think people will associate with the beginning of the pandemic. These are just kind of in the lower nasal cavity, and they swab both nostrils, put in this little tube, and kind of give it back to the person who is watching them take the test. And they send it off, and like I said, they get their results back within 24 hours, which is pretty impressive.
I really like the way you ended your article, kind of the overview of what was going on there at Colby College. And they have a robust testing system, strict mask wearing. They need to be wearing them almost all the time, restricted social gatherings, and willing students. I think that's a very important part of this, because stories that we've been hearing from other schools, the kids are partying, not wearing the masks, all that stuff. But the students there at Colby College really seem to have bought into this. They want in-person instruction. They want to learn that classic way. So they're willing to go through all these steps.
And, you know, I think a part of it, too, is just a lot of the students that I spoke to feel safer on the Colby campus than they do at their own home. You know, I talked to several students from Houston. I talked to a student from Wisconsin. And what they told me is that the way that the virus is being treated in their local communities is nowhere as stringent as it is being treated at Colby. So I think that's a big part of it, too, where it's you have students who really want to get through the semester. They had a hard time with the transition to digital instruction in the spring, and they're kind of aware of what it can look like if things aren't going well. A lot of them also told me that they saw other colleges try and fail to get through their in-person semesters, and I think that was weighing on the minds of a lot of the students as well.
And the result of all these precautions, and they say that it makes everything feel pretty normal, like a normal college campus. They're walking around, they're interacting with each other, they're going to their classes, hanging out with their laptops and everything. It makes it feel like that classic college experience, which I'm sure a lot of them really do appreciate.
What I was struck by when I was on campus was just how normal it was, you know, and they tell you in journalism school, you know, you're not supposed to write about things going quote unquote correctly, but it was extraordinary when you consider the fact that so many colleges have tried to have this in-person experience and just weren't able to do it. And there were kids playing Frisbee and, you know, walking to class and getting their studies done. I mean, it was really impressive to see.
Well, maybe Colby College has the model that a lot of others can copy. We'll see how it goes as the year progresses. Chris Quintana, National Education Reporter at USA Today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Finally for this week, the spooky season is here, and Halloween this year is on a Saturday, meaning that in a normal year, we would see parties and a lot of trick-or-treaters. But this is not a normal year, and many parents are wondering whether they want to risk sending their kids out at all. There's a lot of great resources to assess the risk of sending your kids out, and a lot of alternatives that could be fun as well. For more on what the experts say on if you should be going out trick-or-treating with your kids, we'll speak to Rudri Patel, contributor to The Washington Post.
Well, although the CDC has labeled it high risk, the experts that I spoke with specifically said that you have to look at your own environment and what's going on in your neighborhood. And actually, the CDC has a really helpful color-coded map where parents can actually click on their county and look at what the risk level is. And those counties that fall below between 5 and 10% are considered low risk for infection. And so the experts I talked to said to use that as a guideline, and also to look at your own personal risks. Obviously, if you have a child that's immunocompromised, or if you're an adult who has some of the underlying conditions that have been mentioned, such as diabetes or heart disease or chronic lung issues, then Perhaps it might be a good idea to hold back and not go trick-or-treating. But for most, if you can look at the community risk and assess your personal risk, trick-or-treating can be safe and still an enjoyable activity.
I didn't really think of it before I read your article, but that is a great place to start, the CDC's COVID-19 data tracker, because it's still breaking things down by zip code, which is obviously a larger geographical area than just your immediate neighborhood. But it's a good place to start there. If there's a lot of infections nearby you, you might want to consider some other alternatives. If it's not, then you might be a little freer to go out and do some of that stuff. So that is a really good spot to start. And, you know, you mentioned in the article, too, this Halloween had all the components of being really great. It's on a Saturday. There's going to be a full moon for extra spookiness. You know, it was to be a good time this year. So let's say you decide you are going to take your kids out and you are going to be trick-or-treating. What are some of the precautions you can take? I'm sure hand sanitizer figures heavily into that.
Yeah, I think in some ways the pandemic lends its way toward costumes. So the first obvious one would be have your kids wear a face mask. And for younger kids, some of the costumes, you can easily incorporate a mask into the actual headgear. Despite the age of your children, experts recommend that you accompany your children so you can manage social distancing guidelines by having them stand 6 feet apart and also making sure that they keep their mask on. The big thing that parents should really pay attention to is to avoid congregating outside of doorsteps and porches. So, you know, you want to avoid rooting through a candy bowl. If you see a big crowd, maybe you walk in a different direction. If you're really concerned, you know, use the hand sanitizer after each house. And some kids will be tempted to eat candy while they're trick-or-treating, but parents should make certain hands are clean before kids start touching their faces and eating candy. And as soon as the kids get home, have them shower, wash their hands. And if you're concerned about the candy wrappers, there's no need to disinfect. But as an extra precaution, if you want to store away that candy and buy your own fresh candy to give to your kids, that's also an option.
One of the tips that I saw in your article too that I thought was really good, for those that are handing out candy, instead of maybe doing it at your doorstep, maybe do it in a more spread out area. So like the driveway or just on the lawn or something. That way you limit the amount of things that people are touching.
So the key here is really utilizing open spaces. So like you said, driveways, sidewalks. You could even, if you feel comfortable, use your backyard as space because there's more room back there. And another thing you can do is if you have limited space, then you can set up a table and individually wrap candy. And so that limits contact between the adult handing out the candy and the child.
And finally, some alternatives. There, the CDC labeled a bunch of different activities as high risk, kind of like those trunk or treats that you hear of. Parties that are indoors and haunted houses, they said, are pretty high risk as well. What are some of the other lower risk things that kids can do?
So, you know, you can always carve and display pumpkins. A lot of parents are doing a Halloween scavenger hunt in their backyard. Zoom is something that everybody's doing, so you could hold a virtual costume contest. A lot of people are using their homes to decorate each room with a different theme. And if you have younger kids, that might be fun to have them visit each room for a different surprise. Other people are getting super creative, creating candy chutes to deliver candy to kids without any risk. So I think you can take this as a lesson in creativity for Halloween.
Definitely. I mean, we want everybody to have fun, but also be safe. And then again, you know, once a holiday, something like this comes up, everybody's on the watch for the next 2 weeks. Let's see how many cases might have come out of it. So we'll keep an eye out for all of that. Rudri Patel, contributor to The Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this weekend. Be sure to check out The Daily Dive every Monday through Friday. Join us on social media, at Daily Dive Pod on Twitter and Daily Dive Podcast on Facebook. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow The Daily Dive on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcast. This episode of The Daily Dive has been engineered by Tony Sorrentino. I'm Oscar Ramirez in Los Angeles, and this was your Daily Dive Weekend Edition.